was in the Missions Committee a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about a proposal we're making for the 2020 budget, and said we're going to have to go around and talk to Sunday school classes. And so at the Power and Light class, we're going to need to say there's been a significant change in the denominational landscape, and there's import for that, and we want to tell you what that means. We're going to go to the Journey class and say there are these people called Baptist Mission Partners, and here's who they are, and here's why we give them money. That is to say, if we don't continually do a good job of educating ourselves about what is distinctive about being Baptist, part of which is voluntary cooperation with other folks, and sharing the good word about that, then we will lose that distinctiveness. Baptists are the original champions for religious liberty in America. Back before there was an America, when we were only colonies in Virginia, Baptists were a persecuted people. And there was a wildly influential Baptist minister named John Leland, who had a very famous meeting under a cherry tree with a fellow named James Madison, whose name you probably know. And Leland told Madison, when you go to write a constitution, either in its body or in the First Amendment thereunto, I want you to promise me that there will be a protection from the establishment of religion, a state religion, and a protection for the free exercise of religion. And if you'll do that, I'm going to support you. And if you won't do that, I'm going to make sure that you don't get to go and that the whole convention falls apart, because that's how Baptists negotiate. If it were not for Baptists, there would not be a First Amendment as we understand it. So Baptists have long championed religious liberty and partnered with each other to ensure it not only for ourselves but for all people. So we chartered what used to be called the Baptist Joint Committee for Public Affairs, and since what they really do is religious liberty, they have rebranded the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty. Amanda Tyler is their executive director. Christine Browder in the back is associate executive director. Christine is going to speak with our youth tonight, I think. Is that right, Christine? Amanda is a good Texas girl. She grew up in Austin at Highland Park Baptist Church, which is a sister church to South Main. Went to the East Coast to Georgetown and then back to Austin for UT Law School. Was working in D.C. On a congressional staff when she was asked to come and lead what has long been one of our key partners. So I don't want to steal more time than that from you, Amanda, other than to say thank you for coming to Houston. Thank you for doing training in our church today, and thank you for speaking to us tonight.
Thank you so much for that great introduction. It's so wonderful to be here. I do spend a lot of time in Baptist churches. I've never had such a rousing trivia round as what we just had. I'm really impressed, and I think that's a really fun way to have community with all together. So I hope tonight that this could be a good introduction to BJC for those of you who might be learning about us for the first time, but as well as a good update on what we're doing for the many of you here who have been connected and supported BJC for a long time. Now, what's new, probably for almost everyone since BJC has been here before, is our brand. This is a brand new brand that we unveiled this summer. We have a new color, this orange that we have here, and they are kind of Houston Astros colors, I guess, a little bit. I realized after we've done this rebrand just how many sports teams and colleges have orange and blue, so everyone can kind of adopt us in that way. But we are still Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty. We just found that when we are introducing ourselves, especially to new people, that we wanted to get right to the heart of what we do. And so we rebranded with this tagline that we are about faith, freedom for all. We lead with faith because we come at this from an unabashedly religious perspective, particularly Baptist perspective, for the very reasons that Steve mentioned, because Baptists have been committed for religious liberty for all of our history, and we're going to talk some about that history tonight. We talk about freedom, and we are singularly focused on defending religious freedom for all people. We are the only national denominationally based organization that works solely on protecting religious freedom and the separation of church and state. So that is one of our core distinctives. I am an attorney. There are two other attorneys that serve on our staff. We come at this defending the way that our Constitution defends religious freedom for all, which we'll talk about more in a bit. And we do it for all. And we really mean for all. It's not just for Baptists, but also for Methodists and for Muslims, for Jehovah's Witnesses and for Jews, for Anglicans, and even for atheists. Because we know that if we don't defend everyone's religious freedom, then none of us can have full religious freedom. We do this work not alone, but working together. And we work with we've been around for more than 83 years. We've been a coalition of a number of different kinds of Baptists. Today, we have 16 different denominational bodies that partner with us in our work. I always say, if those groups agreed on everything, there would not be 16 of them. That's just about what it means to be Baptist. But they do all agree about the importance of protecting religious freedom for all, and that's why they've joined together in the work of BJC. But we also work with a number of churches around the country, including South Maine, and I want to thank you all for including us as one of your mission partners. Your support means so much. We also have support from about 1,000 individuals nationwide, many of whom are right here in this church. And increasingly, as we do our work and as denominational life shifts, we increasingly rely on the contributions of generous donors, individuals. And I just want to thank you for being our partners in this work. On this slide, we also have our social handles. And so I want to encourage you all, those of you who are on social media, to please follow us and to share. And even if you're into live tweeting, feel free to live tweet here tonight. We have our website URL, bjconline.org. And as part of our rebrand, we have a completely revamped website. And I really hope that after tonight, you'll go and check out our website and see all of the resources we have available online. Some of those resources I just wanted to highlight here tonight. These are some of our new videos and animations that help tell the story of BJC, about our Baptist history, and also about our work today. And we really hope that these can be resources for you to share and to talk about the work of BJC. We've worked with designers to tell our story and to tell the importance of supporting religious freedom for all in a really visually engaging way that can help get through on social media channels. So why do we have a BJC? Why, for 83 years, have Baptists, across their many other differences, joined together to defend religious freedom for all people? And so I wanted to kind of start with just a quick reminder of theology, of our Baptist theology, and about why religious freedom is so important to us. It starts right in the beginning, in the very first chapter of Genesis, and in the way that God created human beings in God's image, both male and female. And as we know, one of the very first things that those first humans did was disobey God. You know, God could have created robots, perfectly perfect in every way, but God didn't do that. God created us as free beings, free to say yes to God and free to say no to God, and free to accept all of the consequences that come with those answers and decisions. And that kind of freedom is what we Baptists call soul freedom. We see that legacy and that the theology of religious freedom continue in the New Testament, and particularly with Jesus. And this next text is the call. This is Jesus talking about our life in two kingdoms. Jesus articulated the tension that we find ourselves in a trap that was laid for him by the Pharisees working with the Herodians. You know, the Pharisees, as you remember, were religious purists, Jewish patriots who despised Roman rule. Herodians were the descendants of Herod and worked with the Romans. And so these two opposing camps come to Jesus, and because Jesus is starting to threaten them, and they lay a trap. And they asked, you know, the topic was paying taxes. It was as unpopular then, I guess, as it is now. And after some false flattery, they asked Jesus this question that they're sure is going to trick him up. Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not? You know, if he said, yes, it is lawful, he would ruin his credibility with the Jewish people. And if he said no, the Romans might charge him with treason. But Jesus, aware of their malice, according to Matthew's gospel, had the perfect answer. And he made those people give it to him. He said, someone bring me a coin whose head is on this coin. And they said, the emperor. And he said, well, then give therefore to the emperor the things that are the emperor's and to God the things that are God's. And so Jesus's teaching here is more than just an answer to a tax obligation, but gets to the heart of this tension that we continue to find ourselves in today, that we are citizens of two kingdoms, that we are Americans and we are Christians, and those two things are not the same, right? And how do we work out our allegiances to both kingdoms? How do we figure out what to render to which? And an institutional church that is beholden to an institutional state is really at odds with this two-kingdom philosophy that Jesus was teaching us in Matthew's gospel. Well, just a few verses down in the same chapter of Matthew, you know, we also can see the roots of our understanding of religious liberty in Jesus's teaching of the greatest commandment. You know, again, the Pharisees are back again trying to trick Jesus, and this time they send in their lawyer to do it. And he says, you know, which commandment is the greatest? And Jesus, you know, quotes back the Torah to them in Deuteronomy's command to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. But then he adds the twist that we have to see this commandment in our earthly context with a second one like it, that you shall love your neighbor like yourself. And of course, Jesus said on these two commandments hang all the law and all the prophets. So going back to our first theological basis in Genesis and putting it together with this love commandment, we can see a golden rule of religious liberty emerging. That loving our neighbor means standing up and protecting their freedom just as we would our own. So don't ask government to promote your religion if you don't want government to promote someone else's religion. And don't ask government to hinder someone else's religion if you wouldn't ask government to hinder your own. And then finally, you know, in Paul's letter to the Galatians, we see the freedom and the love commandment come together again. Because in this text, Paul says, for freedom, Christ has set us free. But use that freedom to show love for your neighbor. I wanted to add one more verse here when we're talking about advocacy tonight and a history not just of Baptist support for religious freedom, but Baptist advocacy for religious freedom. And Jesus is our original model of advocacy. It comes in this passage from Luke chapter 4. It's Jesus' very first sermon. He goes back to his hometown of Nazareth, and he asks someone to bring him a scroll, and it's the scroll of Isaiah. And Jesus preaches, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free." And so we see Jesus using his ministry, using his very first act of public ministry to advocate on behalf of the poor and the oppressed, and to again use his voice to advocate for the freedom of others. And so building upon this basis of theology, we're going to fast forward from Genesis and Jesus and Paul to the early 17th century in England. Baptists were really in their infancy at this point, and we start to see a group of advocates emerging here who were advocating not for themselves, but for others. This is a rendering of Thomas Ellis, and he wrote in 1612 a short declaration of the mystery of iniquity. It's thought to be the first defense of religious freedom in the English language by this one of the founders of our Baptist movement. And here is a quote from this text, which I've updated it slightly because it's over 400 years old. "For people's religion to God is between God and themselves. The king shall not answer for it. Neither may the king be judge between God and person. Let them be heretics, Turks," which was what they called Muslims, "Jews, or whatsoever, it appertains not to the earthly power to punish them in the least measure. This is made evident to our Lord the King by the scriptures." So Thomas Ellis here is not just writing in the abstract. He is writing directly to King James I. And just in case he might miss the message, Thomas Ellis autographed this piece and sent it straight to the king. Well, the king did not really take very kindly to this message, and he had Thomas Ellis arrested. And Thomas Ellis eventually died in Newgate Prison for his advocacy, not just for Baptists, but for all these other religious groups as well. And so we see our very first religious freedom advocate in the Baptist movement in Thomas Ellis. Well, shortly thereafter, we see Baptist advocacy on these shores. This is, again, a rendering of Roger Williams. Truth be told, Roger Williams was really more known as a seeker. But he spent at least, people estimate, at least 6 months as a Baptist. And so we are going to claim him. And we also claim him because during that 6 months or more, he founded the first Baptist church in America in a place he called Providence, where he went after he was banished from the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And he wrote, of course, extensively and advocated on behalf of religious freedom for all people. This is a quote from Roger Williams from 1641. "It is the will and command of God that since the coming of his son, the Lord Jesus, a permission of the most paganish, Jewish, Turkish, or anti-Christian consciences and worships be granted in all nations and countries, and they are only to be fought with that sword which is only in soul matters able to conquer, with the sword of God's Spirit, the Word of God." And so I really love this quote because Roger Williams was really sure of his religious convictions, whatever they might be at that particular point in his time, till he moved on to the next one. He was a religious exclusivist, you know, and not very permissive in his theological views, but in his political views, he was so expansive and pluralistic in his idea that everyone should have the same freedom that he has on his own. And so this is another example of effective advocacy by one of our Baptist freedom fighter forefathers. The experience of colonial Baptists was that they were minorities in whatever community they found themselves in because they were out of step with whatever established church they had. Buddy Sheridan, who is a Baptist historian and a great defender of religious freedom for all, he wrote in a piece he did called How We Got That Way, "If you ever write a historical essay on early Baptist life in either England or the American colonies, a good place to start your research is in the records of court proceedings, search warrants, and prison records." Because those early Baptists spent a lot of time in trouble with the law for standing up for their own religious beliefs. Steve talked to us about John Leland. Here on the left is a photo of me in that Leland Madison Park, where we have this story of John Leland meeting with James Madison and talking about the importance of including religious freedom for all people in the First Amendment. This is a photo or drawing of John Leland. He wrote in 1791, This is the same year that the First Amendment was ratified. Let every person speak freely without fear, maintain the principles that he believes, worship according to his own faith, either one God, three gods, no God, or 20 gods, and let government protect him in doing so. And I love this quote because this is revolutionary stuff. You know, a Baptist minister advocating for this idea that you can worship 20 gods or no God at all. I think that'd be kind of revolutionary now, let alone in 1791. So here's another example of a strong advocate for religious freedom. My next example I want to give is a modern day photograph, because we don't have photos or renderings of this person. You might see in the photograph someone you recognize in the back, your own Claire Hine Blanton, who was part of the BJC Fellows Program. This is the group from 2018 BJC Fellows as we were gathered in Colonial Williamsburg. And we're learning here from James Ingram, who is portraying Gowan Pamphlet. Gowan was an enslaved tavern worker in Colonial Williamsburg, but he was also the founder of an 18th century all-black Baptist church in Williamsburg. He was applied and eventually granted membership in the white-run Dover Baptist Association. And here, when we think about Baptist freedom fighters, I think too often we ignore the experience of enslaved Africans who were here and had to fight much harder for their religious freedom and their ability to practice. And people like James Madison and John Leland, you know, they were fighting for religious freedom for all, but their conception of all isn't really what we conceive of as all now. And I think this is an important reminder when we talk about Baptist freedom fighters, that we have a more inclusive idea of what that looked like and the different experiences of different Americans and different American Baptists who were fighting for religious freedom over the centuries. And I'm grateful for our BJC Fellows Program, which introduced us to Gowan Pamphlet's story and the ability to share his story with others. And that one of those animations that I showed that's available on our website, we tell the Baptist Freedom Fighter story, and we include Gowan's story in it, as well as the Baptist Freedom Fighters from the Civil Rights Movement, as we talk about the many ways that Baptists through the centuries have been advocating for religious freedom for all. Well, we at the BJC are heirs to this history of advocacy for religious freedom for all. And so I just wanted to talk briefly here about what our work is in Washington. We are headquartered in Washington, D.C., on Capitol Hill, on the Senate side of the Hill, behind the Supreme Court, and across from the Senate side of the Capitol. These are our four main areas of work here that are portrayed. This is a piece from our website. We work with Congress, doing legislative advocacy in members' offices. I had the opportunity last year to testify before a subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee. We are really seen as go-to experts on religious liberty and can work closely with members of Congress and their staffs as they're sorting through the difficult issues as they arise now. We also work in the courts, and I'm going to talk more in depth about that in just a moment. We have a robust educational program. Part of that educational program is the BJC Fellows Program I just mentioned, but we also welcome groups of all kinds into our conference space that's located in our offices with a multimedia board where we mostly student groups, Baptist and non-Baptist, come into our space and we can teach them about religious liberty for all and about the Baptist contributions to that. And we go around the country just like I am here tonight, which is one of my favorite parts of the job, is talking about our work in congregations as well as at schools and seminaries and other community gatherings. Our newest aspect of our work is our call to really equip our supporters to be advocates in their communities for religious liberty for all. And so part of the reason that Christine and I are in Texas this week is that we are on a Texas tour doing some advocacy trainings. And we were here at South Main earlier today with a small group of people who were interested in being trained as advocates in legislative advocacy. And so we talked in depth about some try to demystify the process about talking to our legislators, and then we took that group to Senator Cornyn's office and spoke to their staffers there about how we see religious liberty for all and asking them to support a piece of legislation that BJC is supporting. And so this is really, we think, very important work and work that we're committed to doing because supporting religious liberty for all cannot just be up to the staff of BJC and other like-minded organizations in Washington. It's going to take all of us advocating for religious freedom for all, and we want to be your partners in that work to try to equip you with the information that you need. I did want us to point out that on your tables, I have left a lot of information here I hope you'll look at and take home with you. And there's a sign-up sheet. And if you don't currently get our information and would like to, or if you would like to join our BJC advocacy team where you can get action alerts and be apprised of ways that you can make a difference, I hope you'll sign up and leave your information here with us tonight. Well, I wanted to focus here before I take questions from you all on some of the work that we do in the courts. And most of our work, as I mentioned, we are focused solely on protecting religious freedom for all people. And in the American context, of course, that means in defending our guarantee in our Constitution and specifically the First Amendment, and even more specifically, the first 16 words of the First Amendment, which are here for you tonight, as well as on our handout we have on the table of what is religious liberty, that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And I think it's important to dwell on these 16 words because it's important to see how our constitutional system protects religious freedom, not only by protecting our free exercise rights, our rights to believe and to act on those beliefs without the unnecessary interference by the government, but it also protects against the establishment of religion by the government. That means that government stays neutral with regard to religion. It doesn't prefer one religion over another religion, and it doesn't prefer religion over irreligion. That's the principle. Sometimes that doesn't always take place in our society, right? And now that Baptists who come from this heritage of being at times in our colonial history a persecuted minority, we can forget that now that we're in a comfortable majority privileged status. The importance of government not establishing a religion and what that might do, not only for our brothers and sisters who practice different faiths or who choose not to practice a faith, but also for ourselves. Like what harm the government does to religion when it tries to appropriate it. So this is our legal work, is about helping courts understand how these principles are at work in the cases and controversies that come before them. We do this work by filing friend of the court or amicus briefs, mostly at the Supreme Court, but also in lower courts around the country. BJC filed its first friend of the court brief in 1947, and we've been involved in almost every church-state case since then in one way or the other. I show this rendering. This is a rendering of the inside of a courtroom during an argument. The Supreme Court is one of the last places in the United States where they don't have cameras. They don't have television cameras. They don't allow photography when the court is in session. And so they employ a courtroom artist that draws whenever there's an argument. And these are, you know, souvenirs for the advocates that they can buy this painting and hang it framed in their law office because it's a pinnacle of most litigators' careers to argue a case in front of the United States Supreme Court. I will say, disclaimer, I do not have this hanging in my office, but if you look at the black and white figures at the bottom, the third head from the left is the back of my head. Because this is the day I was sworn into the U.S. Supreme Court bar, and so I got a front row seat for this argument. I say this because I think it's cute. When I found this picture online, I said, that's my head. But I also say, because when these cases come before the court, we at BJC are in the courtroom. We're there to listen to the arguments, to understand them, to help interpret them for you all, to help interpret them also for the media. This is a picture right after that argument. At the microphone is Holly Holman, our general counsel, who has been general counsel of BJC for the last 18 years. She is, I think, one of the finest church-state lawyers in the country, and she is giving commentary to the media immediately after the argument. The woman with the microphone in her face is Nina Totenberg from NPR, who, of course, covers all the Supreme Court cases. And so we can be advocates not only to the court, but also to the media to help understand these complicated church-state cases that come up. And then behind her, you see me, but also Jennifer Hawks, who's our associate general counsel, who's been on staff with us now for 5 years. And so this is our legal team, and I'm really proud of the work that Jennifer and Holly do for us and for all of you at BJC. So I wanted to talk some about the most recent case that we were involved in. I think it gives a window into the work that we do. It had to do with this cross. You might have seen this before. It's sometimes called the Peace Cross. It's standing in Bladensburg, Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C. And it came to the court because it is on government land. And because government money is being used to maintain this cross, it has been there. And it came to the court because it was challenged. Again, we were talking a moment ago about the First Amendment. It was challenged as violating the No Establishment Clause, because government money is, again, being involved in promoting religion here, is the argument. And does this, so the question before the court is, does this government-sponsored cross violate the Establishment Clause? It came to the court under this case called American Legion versus American Humanist Association, and we have a lot of information on this case on our website at bjconline.org/crosscase. This cross is a 40-foot monument. It was completed almost 100 years ago in 1925, and it was originally dedicated to honor 49 servicemen who died in World War I. It started as an individual effort from the community, but then as the area around it grew, a Maryland agency, a government agency, took control of the monument and the land in the 1960s. In the 1980s, the monument was rededicated, and at that time it was rededicated to serve everyone who had ever served in the United States Armed Forces. And these are important facts. I'm going through these facts because these principles as they come to the case are, all these cases are highly fact-specific. So in 2014, the American Humanist Association filed suit, and they claimed that this cross violated the Establishment Clause because of the government's maintenance and control of it. I want to be clear about that. It's not that having a cross out in the public violates it, right? We see crosses all over. It's that the government was involved in propping up and maintaining this cross. And so wanted to give you a sense of what this looks like in context. It's in the middle of a very busy traffic area. That's why the government took control over it. It's really big. In fact, it had become kind of a landmark for this community. People would say, you know, oh, go to the cross and turn right. You know, it became known. This town became known because they have a 40-foot cross in the middle of it. And so, you know, when it came to the court, again, BJC, we don't actually file court cases. We don't represent clients. But when these cases come up to the Supreme Court, that's usually when we get involved. And so at this point, it was how are we going to get involved in this case? And we very quickly knew that if this did not constitute an establishment of religion, not much else did, right? That this is a pretty clear, for us, establishment of religion. But the way that we got involved was not to make that argument. There were a lot of other, you know, groups making that argument. Our brief really focused a lot on theology, which is kind of remarkable, I think, but it's something that only BJC could do. And our brief had to defend the religious meaning of the cross. That might seem pretty remarkable to you, but we had to because the government wasn't claiming that the government could go around erecting crosses on public land. They said that they could do this because the cross was a secular symbol, that the cross had taken on this meaning just to be generic for all war dead, and that it had lost its religious meaning, which for us is really alarming and is a sign that why, again, as I was saying earlier, that establishment by government doesn't just harm minority religions or those in the minority, it can harm those in the majority because when the government takes it over, the government starts to speak on behalf of religion in some ways that can be very harmful to our faith. And so our brief, which we wrote with Professor Doug Laycock, who spent much of his career at the University of Texas School of Law and who's one of the leading academics on church-state law, we worked very closely with him in writing our brief, which was, again, about half theology and half law. And we were joined not only by other Christian groups, and I point out this because we often work in coalition with other groups. We were the lead on this one, but we joined with Lutherans and UCC and Presbyterians, but also Jewish groups. And we were all making kind of a similar argument that the idea that the cross is a secular symbol is offensive to us all. It's offensive to Christians, I think, for obvious reasons, but it's also offensive to non-Christians because they know full and well that this is a religious symbol and it's one that they don't share. And so the idea that this is just a generic symbol of death and sacrifice that stands for all people, these Jewish groups were saying, I recognize the cross as a religious symbol, and I recognize that it does not stand for me. And so to say that a cross stands for all Americans is either to say the cross doesn't mean much at all, or to assume that all Americans are Christians. And neither of those propositions is true. The facts of this case I wanted to distinguish, too, because these were some other arguments that were being made in the case. This standalone cross is very different than the religious symbols that are found here on gravestones in Arlington National Cemetery, where in these cases, and if you can see in the photo, we have a cross, we have a Star of David, and we have a crescent. You know, this is more like individual expression, that the family members of the fallen soldiers, they choose what religious symbol to put on these grave markers, and they have, I can't remember, 30, 40, or 50 different symbols from which they can choose, right? So that alone, I think, is an acknowledgement that the cross can't stand for everyone, because if it did, they wouldn't have that many choices for the family members to choose for their headstones. Also here, this is a cemetery in Europe from World War I. And there was this other argument being made that the cross during World War I, that was just a generic symbol for sacrifice. Well, you see in the foreground that there is a Star of David here. So even then, right after World War I, they knew that the cross didn't stand for everyone. And there were choices to put other symbols up, even in these European cemeteries. We got this image of crosses of crosses upon crosses because most of them were Christian. But it's important to note that they weren't all Christian. So what did the court do in this case? And I think some of this can be helpful in this case, but also when you hear news about other cases. You know, it was 7-2. There are 9 justices on the Supreme Court. 7-2 looks like we lost in a landslide. Not exactly, I would say. 7 justices did say that this cross could remain. But they had a lot of different reasons for it. In fact, there were six opinions for those seven votes in the majority. So they came at this in very different ways. Only two justices would have argued that the cross should be either transferred to private control or moved off government land or something else should be done so that the government was no longer propping it up. Our brief, BJC's brief, was quoted half a dozen times in the dissent. And I point this out because that is very rare for an amicus brief to be quoted at all or cited at all, let alone so many times. And I think it shows not only its importance to the dissent, but also when we talk about what the court, the majority, actually decided, the importance that our voice played in this decision. Because even though the cross remains, the court made clear in its majority opinion that it was not accepting the government's argument that the cross was a secular symbol. And so I feel like our advocacy on behalf of the religious meaning of the cross was heard and answered in the opinion of the court. What they said is they really focused on the unique history of this monument. They said it was more than 90 years old and it had gone unchallenged for decades. So would the case have been different if there had been groups earlier in its history challenging its unconstitutionality? Perhaps, right? But it hadn't gone until 2014, and then it was by the American Humanist Association, a group that is, you know, often, I think, pointed out that people argue that they're being somehow anti-Christian. So it was important for us to join with our humanist brothers and sisters in supporting them and their advocacy in this case as well. The court also focused on that fact I said earlier that the originally was dedicated to these 49 soldiers who the historical record shows apparently were all Christian. And so they really focused on that fact. Now, they ignored the fact that in the 1980s, it was rededicated to stand for all people. That was not a convenient fact for the court's majority opinion, so that was ignored. Instead, they focused on its original history. They also said that the history lacked proof of explicit intent to disrespect diversity or to divide citizens. And I think we have to take into the historical context here that 1925 was a very different time than 2019, and how maybe there was no explicit intent to disrespect, but perhaps those in the minority there did not feel the same sense of safety and security in speaking up for their rights then as they would now. But that was one piece of the history of this cross that the court found important. And finally, they said this had become a recognizable community landmark. People say turn right at the cross. That was important to this community, that it would be more divisive for this community to take down this cross than to leave it standing. And there was an argument in our brief that acknowledged that. You know, we knew, we thought it was very unlikely that the court would say that they were going to move this cross in some way. And that at certain times, it can be more divisive to take down landmarks and more harmful for our relations, you know, with religious liberty than it would be to let it stand. And I think that is this important message at the end. The court said, retaining established, religiously expressive monuments, symbols, and practices is quite different from erecting or adopting new ones. They were saying, we're going to rule this way for this cross. We're not setting precedent for new ones. Now, they put this in the opinion, but this case was quickly picked up, including by the administration in some cases, to allow new expression of religion by the government. And so I think this is our final piece of advocacy here, you know, that sometimes we as Christians in the majority, as Baptists, when we see something, we have to say something, right? When we see new monuments going up or new expressions of religion, even if it's our religion by the government, it's our responsibility to be that witness and to stand up for our neighbors, but also for ourselves and for our faith, to raise questions about the government's responsibility and role in promoting our faith. So that is the end of my presentation, but I'd love with our remaining time to take any questions or conversation you all might have about BJC and about our work. Yes, Ed. Sure. So the question is, can we give an example of how we've advocated for free exercise? We've had a very long history of doing this, and I think our kind of the high watermark of our contributions to this came because we chaired the coalition that passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which now goes by RFRA, in the 1990s. Then we chaired the coalition that passed the next piece of legislation called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act in 2000. I was on staff when that act passed and played a role in helping get passed. And those two laws try to set out a standard that says that the government should only interfere in the free exercise of religion when it is absolutely necessary to protect a government interest of the highest order. And those highest order examples include public health and safety and protecting the rights of others. Because we know that we live in community with people of all different kinds of religion and religious expression and those who don't practice religion at all. We can't have unlimited free exercise. We wouldn't make it out of the parking lot with our unlimited free exercise rights, right? Here in our house of worship, we have the highest level of free exercise rights we have, and BJC is one of the strongest defenders of making sure that our houses of worship can make their own choices and be free to exercise their religion in any way that we can. But when we get into the broader world and we're encountering people and the government has interest in protecting their rights as much as ours, then we have to look at ways that we balance our rights. And we continue to think that the best way to balance it is the standard that's put out in the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and in RLUIPA. And we see challenges coming up to the court in those instances. And, you know, one of the recent cases that came up, particularly the RLUIPA standard, here's an example. Again, in certain contexts where it's particularly important to make sure the government isn't overstepping and infringing on free exercise rights, or is in prison, right, where almost all liberty is taken away. But even there, you don't shed your religious liberty rights. The government obviously has an important interest in protecting health and safety, but they don't have an interest that can just be manufactured that tramples on free exercise rights. So in 2014, a case came to the Supreme Court where a Muslim prisoner in Arkansas wanted to grow a half-inch beard for a religious reason. And the prison said no, he couldn't grow a half-inch beard because he might hide contraband in the beard, which is just a ludicrous reason, right? What kind of contraband could you possibly hide in a beard like that? Or what other ways might the government be able to search your beard to be sure that you're not hiding something there would cause harm to someone else? And so the BJC filed a brief in that case, defending RLUIPA as a law, defending that standard, and explaining how, if you applied that in this context, that this prisoner's free exercise rights were being trampled on. So that's an example of our free exercise work and our continued work of supporting the rights of free exercise for all Americans. Yeah. Yeah. So atheism is not a religion, and I don't claim that it is, but I support their rights not to be religious as much as I support religious people's rights to be whatever religion they choose. And so I think when we see the rights of non-religious Americans, and it's sometimes hard to judge what number that is. I think now about a fifth of all Americans, or getting close to a quarter, do not claim a specific religious tradition. Those numbers are much higher among younger Americans. I'm quick to point out that those people are not necessarily non-religious. They just don't claim a particular faith tradition. They might be, as we commonly hear, spiritual but not religious, right? But they have every much a right to be an American citizen as we do. And so sometimes, particularly we see this in the establishment, in government establishment, that when government prefers being religious over non-religious, that they are harming the religious liberty of those individuals because they have religious liberty not to be religious, right? And so that's how we see that in that, you know, from a theological perspective, that we cannot have the freedom to say yes to God if we don't have the freedom to say no to God. And today in our advocacy visits and our visit with Senator Cornyn, we were advocating on behalf of a resolution that's coming before Congress that would ask the Congress to send a message, to have a sense of the Congress resolution, to push for and prioritize the repeal of anti-blasphemy laws around the world. About a third of the world's countries still have these anti-blasphemy, heresy, apostasy laws in their books, which makes it a crime not to believe with a state religion. Right. And so in those cases, we are advocating on behalf of religious dissenters and also of non-theistic individuals for their rights to have their choice of religion separate from government control. That makes sense. Yeah, then I'll come to you. Yeah, so the question is how do we interpret in the education context science versus religious beliefs? Yeah, like in evolution or the teaching of evolution. So BJC has for decades stood up to government-sponsored religion and what that might look like in public schools. Often we see that with some kind of government-sponsored religious exercise, like we saw before the 1960s in government-sponsored prayer or government-sponsored compulsory Bible readings. But we've also seen this come up in maybe creationism or the teaching of creationism in the public schools. And so we have stood up to that we think public schools should not have government-sponsored religion in them. It doesn't mean that there's no religious exercise in public schools, right, that individual students and teachers is a little more complicated because they're a hybrid of a state, a state person and an individual person. They don't shed all their rights as individuals at the door either. But there are certain places, certainly in campus and in their break rooms and places where they're not sending a message or trying to act as an agent of the state. But that children have the rights to, you know, bring the Bible to their schools and the right to pray in a way that isn't interfering with the instruction at school. They have the right to write papers about religious topics when it's on point, right? That there's, you know, we hear sometimes stories about where maybe well-meaning public school teachers are being overly concerned about the government-sponsored religion. And BJC puts out quite a lot of educational materials about all the different kinds of religious expression that can and should happen in public schools that doesn't cross the line into government-sponsored religion. We haven't had an issue in recent memory where we've gotten involved in an evolution, the teaching of evolution versus creationism context. I think where we are getting more involved in raising our advocacy now, there's been a push in recent years to pass Bible literacy classes in the legislatures. Our stance on these is on their face, they look constitutional because they're talking about teaching the Bible in a non-sectarian way, in a way that wouldn't be religious indoctrination but is informational. So on the face, they're probably constitutional. We think they're totally unnecessary because the Supreme Court said back in the 1960s that that's already allowed. So why do we need a law that says that's allowed? And what we're concerned about is the message that that's sending when we pass laws like that is that in order to be a full American, an educated American, then you've really got to know your Bible. And some of the language in these bills talk about the importance. It's not just about, you know, knowing the history or knowing the, you know, what influence this had on literary or on art, but it's about imparting spiritual values. And we, frankly, don't trust the public schools to be spiritual teachers, right, for one, nor do we think that that is respectful of religious diversity in the schools, and particularly when children are involved because they're so impressionable and vulnerable. And so it's important that we keep government-sponsored religion out of public schools. Yeah, so the question is whether churches should have tax-exempt status. So churches are nonprofit organizations. 501c3 is the kind of organization that almost all churches are. We fully support that. There are lots of different kinds of 501c3 organizations out there, educational and healthcare and arts and, runs the gamut. And religious organizations are one of them. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but churches get special status with the IRS that we don't actually have to file for tax-exempt status. Churches and other houses of worship are assumed to be religious organizations, and so that's a nice lifting of the burden for churches, which we fully support. Churches also don't have to file what's called a Form 990, which is, as I understand it, a very onerous form to file for most nonprofits, so that's another lifting of a burden for churches that we fully support, because many churches are much smaller than South Main, don't have the resources to hire the accountants and to file those kinds of forms. I think what you might be referencing was a very ill-advised and I think wrong comment that came from then-candidate Beto O'Rourke in a debate where he said that churches should lose their tax-exempt status if they hold certain positions. I absolutely disagree with that comment, as did, I think, almost every other candidate that spoke on the issue. And he quickly retracted that comment because I think he realized how wrong that was as well. So I don't think there is an actual threat out there that churches would lose their tax-exempt status. BJC has gotten more involved recently in this issue because the president prioritized something he called repealing the Johnson Amendment. The Johnson Amendment is something named after Lyndon Baines Johnson. It's been in our tax code since 1954 that says that all 501c3 organizations, not just churches, but anyone who has that special tax designation, will not be involved in political partisan campaigning for public office. And we think that's a very good rule. It's something that helps keep partisan campaigning out of our houses of worship. It helps churches and other houses of worship from being used for their tax status. And it has not been as hot of an issue over the last year or so, but for the first 2 years when I was in this position, it was really a real threat. We thought that the Congress was about to change the law in a way that would permit partisan campaigning in houses of worship. And, we worried about the divisiveness that would come in our houses of worship, the idea that, people could no longer worship together across partisan lines because churches would be taking positions or be pressured to taking positions in partisan races, not just national elections, but yesterday was election day. What if this church, you had candidates at all the way out your door asking for your endorsement every campaign season? You'd never do anything but that, right? And I think the most concerning piece you know, those were all concerning pieces from a religious perspective. I think the larger piece and what I think will ultimately hopefully doom this proposal is that there were estimates from the nonpartisan committee that goes through and estimates what kind of impact this would have on the tax law, billions of dollars of campaign spending being funneled through churches and other houses of worship, something, again, being used in such a way that would really harm not only our larger political system, but also the reputation and the integrity of our houses of worship. So that's the main area where BJC has been standing up for the tax status of churches, but also against being used, our tax status being used by others for the for their partisan ends. Yeah. So the question is whether we took a position on that was a particular case called the Masterpiece Cake Shop case that came to the court last year, I guess. It came to the court. And we did take a position in that case, and we continue to follow them. I will say these, I think, are the toughest issues kind of coming up for religious freedom right now, and they are very complicated. And I'll say, before I talk about how we came down on that case, I'll say the only people I don't think you should believe in these cases are those who tell you it's easy on either side, because they're not. And they're so fact-specific, and they're so specific to the particular context. So let me tell you about that case. It was the challenge. It was in Colorado, and they had a state ordinance that prohibited the discrimination against all kinds of different protected groups in places of public accommodation. That's basically business, as they defined it in their law, businesses open to the public. And so you couldn't be discriminated against based on your race, your gender, your religion, different status, or your LGBT status. And there was a business owner there who owned a bakery named Jack Phillips, Masterpiece Cake Shop. A gay couple came into their business. They wanted to celebrate their marriage. They actually weren't gay marriage at that time was not legal in Colorado. So they had been married in Massachusetts. They wanted to have a reception in Colorado. They wanted to have a cake. And they came in and said, "Will you bake a cake? You know, we're getting married. We'd like a cake." And before they even discussed what they wanted, he said, "No, I can't. It's against my religion to bake a cake for your wedding." And so then it was challenged, and it went before a the first court, a commission that decided it. Then it went to the appellate court. The couple won in both instances, and then it went to the Supreme Court. And BJC, we looked at the case, and we said, in this particular case, in this particular context, where we have a law of public accommodation supporting, you know, non-discrimination in places of public accommodation, in this place where the actual exercise that the baker was doing was very far removed from the actual religious ceremony, where he wasn't having to attend anything, that all of his work was done in the bakery. And this is a very important fact, in a state where they do not have a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, they don't have a heightened protection for free exercise there, that we did not see a legal way to carve out an exception for this baker that would not harm religious liberty in the outcome. And that's because there was no way to carve out an accommodation, we thought, that would not say that the next baker could not deny someone because their religious beliefs didn't support interfaith marriage. So someone could be turned away because they were in an interfaith marriage. Or someone else said, "Well, my religion doesn't support interracial marriage, so I'm not going to serve you." And so then we really are starting to break down our non-discrimination laws in this context. Last example, you might say, that's really far-fetched. Would anyone in this day and time actually say that? Well, someone in this day and in this time and in Mississippi did say that recently, that their religious beliefs did not believe in interracial marriage, and so they wouldn't serve them. It was in some other wedding vendor context, maybe flowers or something like that. So I think I say all of this to say these are really very complicated questions, and the context really matters. That case, the Supreme Court did not decide that case or that issue. The way they decided that case is they said that that first commission that heard the Baker's claim, that they denigrated his religion in deciding the case. And the way that they talked about the case, that they were not neutral with regard to religion, and that violated that person's free exercise rights. We could have a whole conversation about those statements that were made and whether they really were denigrating religion. I think the court did not want to decide this case. And so the case went back down. There have been subsequent legal challenges that have all been dismissed. But the bakery has not reopened, or has not reopened its wedding cake business. So it continues to do other business, but they don't do wedding cakes because the Supreme Court gave no guidance on whether it would be allowed or not. We're seeing the same controversy continue to come up in other states with other laws, with other facts, in other areas where maybe the vendor is going to be more involved in the actual religious ceremony. And BJC will just have to wait and see what those facts look like. And our single question we ask ourselves whenever these cases come up is, how do we think religious liberty is best going to be served in this example? We don't have a position on any other issue other than serving religious liberty. And so when that next case comes up, we'll be looking at that closely and seeing how we'll be involved. That's the Arlene Flowers case. Yeah. And so we don't have a position on that case. And if it comes, it's been filed. So that case is the same kind of fact situation, but she's a florist. Right. So they were customers of hers. So, you know, the Supreme Court has not said they're going to hear that case yet. But if they do, then at that point, we would look at the facts and get involved and decide whether we'd file, and if so, where our voice needed to be in that case. Yeah. Wonderful questions. Thank you so much for engaging.
And to thank you for traveling all this way, and thanks for being here with us. Why don't we close in prayer tonight? Lord, we're grateful that we have a house that is your house and we can gather to pray to you. And we're grateful that we can go outside the walls of this place and do the work of your kingdom in the world, bringing the kingdom of God on earth as it is in heaven. And we're grateful that we can do it in this really exceptionally wonderful country. So we give you thanks for our freedom, and we pray that you would give us resolve to advocate for the freedom, religious freedom of all people, including our freedom to persuade them to join us. Help us this night to be faithful to you and grateful to you in Jesus' name. Amen.